From Tribune Tower, WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything that's in the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good morning, and for those of you who celebrate it, happy Easter. For those of you who don't, happy first week of spring, and hope that you're up and enjoying this beautiful day. To the regular listeners, no, you haven't gone batty or bunny, as the case may be. You're not hearing Rick Pearson. He's taking a well-deserved day off. So I'm your fill-in this fine morning on the Sunday Spin. I'm Amanda Vinicky. I've had the pleasure of being on the airwaves here on WGN with Rick on occasion, but you'll more regularly hear me on Illinois public radio stations, where I'm State House Bureau Chief down in Springfield. For those of you who are listening live rather than via podcast, because if you do happen to, you know, I don't know, not off in bed while you're listening, never fear, you can catch back up with us because this show is available via podcast. A couple of things. Number one, be warned, I'm not a morning person, though I do have coffee in hand. And two, once this program is over, I'm going to have a monster brunch. My family is in town. We're going to, I think it's actually kind of a political hangout, the Chicago Cut. Have you ever been there, Dave?
I have not, but I think you're correct in saying that it's a Chicago hangout. I haven't been.
Yeah.
I hope you enjoy it.
I hope so. I expect to. But, all right, so what I'm really excited about, so this is something that my mom likes. She went there for, I believe, Thanksgiving. We're not chefs in my family. And
who wants to clean up?
Right? Exactly. Who wants to go to the grocery store? That's my thing.
I like the grocery store.
You do?
I don't like cleaning up.
I don't like any of it. I get groceries delivered. I'm at that point.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I know. The verge of millennial right here.
I guess so.
But I will today. Okay, so this is what I love, love, love. I don't have children or anything, so I don't buy any candy in advance of the Easter holiday. But my trick, and I'll share it with the rest of you because I don't need to buy it all, and it's a pretty obvious trick. Later today or maybe tomorrow morning, wake up bright and early and hit the drugstore to buy up all of the newly discounted Cadbury eggs and Reese's peanut butter eggs, which are so much better than just a regular Reese's candy bar a Snicker. Have you tried them?
Yeah.
If you get the ratio right, you know?
Do you do the same thing after Valentine's Day to get the discounted Valentine's Day candy?
I would take a Cadbury egg and a Reese's or a Snickers egg over Valentine's Day candy any day.
That good move. My suggestion is don't save it until next year. use it as soon as possible.
There is no question of that being an issue. They are delicious. Do you have a favorite Easter candy?
You know what my favorite Easter candy was when I was a kid? I still see them around. Those little yellow chickens. Those little
Peeps.
Chicks.
Peeps, you mean?
Peeps, that's what they are. Yes. We would get just you could buy them in a box of a dozen maybe, or 18, you know, three rows of six. And, I'd just consume one of those one right after another. And, of course, you hear, don't eat too many of those. You will ruin your dinner, which I did.
But who cares?
Those are my favorites. Yeah. And if I see those discounted tomorrow, Amanda,
they will be on sale.
I'll get some and I'll send you a box, too.
Those are kind of a love-hate candy. What I like to do with Peeps, and this is more just because it's funny, my mom taught me this trick, so I guess it's kid-friendly. I remember doing it. You got to be careful. But blowing them up in the microwave. You put it in, and they get huge, of course, because they're mostly marshmallow.
We did not have a microwave to do that. I'm going back to the 1960s here, Amanda. So,
I missed that, but they produced some quality TV shows.
Yes,
but
they did.
When you buy them on discount tomorrow, you can buy an extra and microwave it, and it's good for a laugh. It is. Or also a good Google search. Do you know about this? I think the Washington Post actually publishes it every year, but people make these elaborate scenes out of Peep Bunnies and Peep Chicks.
Oh, I'm not surprised. Get creative with them.
It's incredible. I had for a while, my screensaver was Peeps doing yoga. They were in Down Dog or Down Rabbit
or whatever it was. Or a tree pose of some sort.
Yeah, it's really, I mean, that is worth your Sunday morning fun. You know, I actually studied in London or worked for Parliament. I had an internship for British Parliament out of college, which was one of the more incredible experiences ever.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but every day we would, you know, take the tube to work and it was awesome. There was one tube stop and I kid you not, they had a vending machine that was just Cadbury eggs.
Oh, really?
That was the only thing that it carried year round, not just Easter. Year round.
Well, I say, since you mentioned yoga poses with Peeps, I think this might be something new that we can introduce on the Sunday Spin. We'll have to talk to Rick about this.
Okay, all right.
Especially because he does the show in the Allstate Showcase studio where you are now. Maybe take a couple of minutes to do a little yoga before we get into our political discourse.
I think that could be healthy. I believe, actually, there was a Tribune columnist, Mary Schmirch, did a column about her desire to bring the governor and legislative leaders together and
have them just
say,
just a little bit of Zen, the deep cleansing breath. I think that's a very good idea.
It really does help. I am a yogi myself, and I loved the thought of it. I thought about trying to extend an invitation to the leaders and see who would show up. But seeing as they're evidently not even calling one another back,
I'm a little doubtful.
I don't know. It's insane to me, right?
It's unprecedented. Here we are into the spring legislative session for 2016, and we don't have a budget for 2015.
Mm-hmm. It really is.
I laugh, but it's not a laughing
matter. No, I feel like it's just one of those things where, you know, there's just basic human decency and manners. Like, you get together, you talk, and those have been eclipsed at this point, and it is frustrating. And, of course, we'll be talking about some of those frustrations later on in the show. We got a couple of state legislators that will be joining us on the program here on the Sunday Spin. I wanted to make sure that everybody knows we have our wonderful engineer, Bob, on the scene and producer, Jasmine. She's fielding calls. And you can text in, too, 312-981-7200. Or you can find us on Facebook and write us there. It's facebook.com/thesundayspin. My favorite medium, Twitter. We're at Sunday Spin. That's the handle there. So any of those ways, feel free and write in about your favorite Easter candy or when we get into the more in-depth issues later on. And we would love to hear from you. I'm Amanda Vinicky, and this is The Sunday Spin.
Should have built a wall. Mother, should I run for president?
Good morning, Amanda Vinicky here with the Sunday Spin, and we've got a quality lineup this morning, if I do say so myself. We'll begin, of course, in just a bit with taking a spin on what's going on in the national political scene. And this week, as with so many others, this 2016 election cycle was a doozy. Then, fresh off a pair of major court decisions affecting unions, we have Roberta Lynch. She's head of the state's largest public employees union, AFSCME. In the 8 o'clock hour, two legislators, a Republican and Democratic member of the House, and last but not least, director of Illinois' Department of Juvenile Justice. And before we get too deep there into politics, a heads up that though I know you're missing Mr. Pearson today, there's a chance you can catch up with him and get some extra insight before next Sunday on Friday. That's April Fool's Day, April 1st, but I'm not kidding here. Warning, some seats are sold out already, though. At noon, he's leading a discussion for the first Friday Club at the City Club of Chicago. As a lover of both Rick Witt and the Wizard of Oz, I gotta say, I like the title. His talk is called We have never been down this road before. Where is this yellow brick road taking us? Whether he'll focus on Illinois politics or the federal landscape, I don't know, but I think the title is apt for both. Let's settle in on that national political scene front for now. Yes, it is time for the Sunday Spin. I know Rick would say that it's time to grab a cup of coffee and the Sunday paper, but I'll give you a pass to instead go for a mojito this morning in the spirit of President Barack Obama's trip to Havana. It was the first time since the revolution, so in more than half a century, that the presidents of the United States and Cuba met on Cuban soil. Raul Castro and President Obama held a joint press conference at which Obama prodded Castro to actually answer journalists' questions. A rarity there. Obama delivered a speech that aired live on Cuban television in which he advocated for America to lift its trade embargo, was self or country effacing in a way, saying that there is too much money in U.S. politics. And during that speech, he openly challenged Castro to lighten up on dissidents.
And there's already an evolution taking place inside of Cuba, a generational change. Many suggested that I come here and ask the people of Cuba to tear something down. But I'm appealing to the young people of Cuba who will lift something up, build something new. El futuro de Cuba tiene que estar en las manos del pueblo cubano.
Cuba's future has to be in the hands of the Cuban people.
And to President Castro, who I appreciate being here today, I want you to know, I believe my visit here demonstrates you do not need to fear a threat from the United States. And given your commitment to Cuba's sovereignty and self-determination, I am also confident that you need not fear the different voices of the Cuban people and their capacity to speak and assemble and vote for their leaders. In fact, I am hopeful for the future because I trust that the Cuban people will make the right decisions.
It is the season known for growth and rebirth, and this is seen as a new beginning. But beyond those who believe Obama's going easy on Cuba and getting zip in return, it didn't all go smoothly. And I'm not just talking about Obama's incredibly awkward handshake, limp arm raise, wrist hold thing with Raul Castro. Radio cannot do it justice, so if you didn't see that, find a video online. But critics were upset that Obama attended a baseball game there in Cuba after the horrific news of a terror attack in Brussels that left 31 people dead. ISIS has claimed responsibility. Obama justified going to that ballgame, saying the whole premise of terrorism is to try to disrupt people's ordinary lives. But for Republicans trying to win the presidency, it was the wrong call. Ohio Governor John Kasich called on Obama to return home immediately. Kasich this week rebuffed calls to drop out of the primary, leaving it to a two-way race between Donald Trump and Ted Cruz. In the wake of the attacks, Trump said the United States should use interrogation techniques like waterboarding or even go harsher, and he doubled down in his calls for border control and tightening up on immigration.
I would be extremely careful about people from the Middle East coming into our country. I would be extremely careful as to what's going on. You have an ISIS problem that's a massive problem. They want to come in. They want to do big damage. And I would be extremely careful about that.
Trump had other announcements about his international policy over the week. He hinted at withdrawing from NATO and unveiled that his mindset when dealing with other countries will be America first. That's his slogan there. A pair of lengthy sit-downs Trump had with editorial boards at the Washington Post and New York Times are worth a read, too, by the way. In response to the attacks in Brussels, Ted Cruz called for patrolling of Muslim neighborhoods here in America. But he separated from Trump otherwise, criticizing the frontrunner's non-interventionist and trade ideas. That dispute over foreign policy was not, however, what put Cruz and Trump in the headlines for most of the week, however. No. The Republican primary turned into a name-calling, chest-pounding social media slugfest over the presidential candidates' ladies and their looks. It all evidently started with an ad produced by a super PAC, so not the Cruz campaign itself, featuring a photo of Trump's model wife, warning Utah's heavily Mormon and conservative voting base about the prospect of someone who'd posed in the Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue being the potential future first lady. Now, anybody who knows me on... and follows me on Twitter knows I love it. But wow, what Twitter did this week. Trump took to the social medium to write, "Be careful, Lion Ted, or I will spill the beans on your wife." He then followed up by retweeting what somebody else had posted online, a not particularly flattering photo of Cruz's wife paired with a glamour shot of his own, saying, "No need to spill the beans. The images are worth a thousand words." And go figure, that ticked off Cruz.
Donald, you're a sniveling coward, and leave Heidi the hell alone. Real men don't try to bully women. That's not an action of strength. That's an action of weakness. It's an action of fear. It's an action of a small and petty man.
Who said politics is boring? Or classy, for that matter. It did not end there. Whatever Trump meant by spill the beans, the National Enquirer came out with a report alleging that Cruz, a conservative Christian of infidelity, that probably would have just stayed in the tabloids had not a Trump supporter accused a Cruz supporter and former spokeswoman who, like me, warning for what you'll hear in this upcoming clip, is named Amanda, of having an affair with Cruz. And this happened on live TV. Here you go.
If we're going to call Donald Trump's character into question, I would like Ted Cruz to issue a statement whether or not the National Enquirer story is true, that he has had affairs with many women, including you were named, Amanda. Will you denounce this story, or will you confirm it?
All right, let me step in really quick. Amanda, I will give you a second to let me just be very clear. It will come as no surprise to our viewers. CNN has no reporting on what you're talking about coming from the National Enquirer. Amanda, go ahead.
I mean, what's out there is tabloid trash. If someone wants to comment on it, they can talk to my lawyer. It is categorically false. You should be ashamed for spreading this kind of smut. Donald Trump supporters should be held to account for it.
I'm not spreading intimidated. Smut.
I will continue to make my thoughts known about Donald Trump, and I am not backing down.
Cruz did say that report is false, denies any extramarital affair. He blames Trump for planning the story and in bizarre fashion called Trump a rat. Before all of this, Jeb Bush, remember back when pundits expected he was going to clinch the GOP nomination, used Twitter in a more urbane fashion to announce he was endorsing Cruz. Another fallen GOP presidential candidate, South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham, also came out for Cruz. He wasn't thrilled about it, but he was funny. Here he is on The Daily Show with Trevor Noah.
You really don't like Ted Cruz.
I don't dislike Ted. Ted and I have a lot of differences. I'm getting better at this. So,
you know what I feel? I feel like you guys are like a buddy cop movie.
15th choice. What can I say? One, he's not completely crazy. Good. He's
so
really
partially crazy. Partially crazy.
Well, hey, that works in Washington. You got Bernie.
Okay. Not fully crazy. Bernie. Yeah, that's a tick. What else is a tick for him? What turns you on about Cruz?
That he's not Trump.
And we will reach across the aisle later with your Sunday Spin.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
No. It's Amanda Vinicky just subbing in for Mr. Pearson this week and this week only. Want to make sure that we round out that national spin there. So going both across the aisle and switching the TV channel to yet another late night laughs rolling for you early morning risers who maybe aren't watching those late night shows. Talk show host Jimmy Kimmel had Democratic frontrunner Hillary Clinton stand at a podium and give her stump speech so he could carry out a special type of critique of it, the mansplain.
So you just want me to talk?
Yeah, just talk and I'll correct you whenever I feel the need.
Well, thank you. It's wonderful to be here
okay,
with all of you.
Okay, hold on one second.
Already?
You're
already
shouting. You're too loud. You don't have to shout like that. It hurts my ears. It comes off as a little shrill.
I got to say, as someone who, you know, is on the radio or even TV from time to time, I've been there and heard some of that. Kimmel's advice did not work all that well for Clinton. However, this week, she is still solidly in the lead with delegates, but Bernie Sanders had basically a sweep. He won the caucuses in Washington and Alaska and Hawaii last night. And on Tuesday, he easily took Utah. Clinton did on Tuesday win Arizona. Now, in an apparent attempt to break out of this March Madness political season, House Speaker Paul Ryan gave a much-hyped speech on Capitol Hill.
Our political discourse, both the kind that we see on TV and the kind that we experience among each other, it did not used to be this bad, and it does not have to be this way.
It was a bipartisan political reckoning of sorts. Vice President Joe Biden also gave a speech in which he bemoaned the Senate's refusal to move on Obama's Supreme Court nominee.
We're watching a constitutional crisis in the making, born out of dysfunction in Washington. It's got to stop. It really does, for the sake of both parties, for the sake of the country, for the sake of our ability to govern. It's got to stop.
And with that, I'm going to stop on the national spin because I have been joined by Roberta Lynch. She is the director of Illinois' largest public employees union, AFSCME Council 31. Thanks so much. And good morning, Roberta.
Good morning, Amanda. How are you?
I'm great. I'm thrilled to have you here because it was a significant week for labor unions in Illinois. We had a couple of key decisions coming out of the Illinois Supreme Court. So let's take those one by one. First of which is a pension ruling that seems to echo really what happened when lawmakers sought to bring down this, what the state owes in its pensions. There was a this dismissed a Chicago pension plan. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, last year, the Illinois Supreme Court ruled on a pension law that pertained to teachers all over the state, except for Chicago, and state employees, university employees. And they said very clearly, under our Constitution, pension benefits earned can't be diminished or impaired. And the city of Chicago then, for whatever reason, I don't know, also tried to pass a similar piece of legislation affecting some portion of City of Chicago employees with the same idea, significantly cutting the benefits of both active and retired City of Chicago employees who have very modest pensions, don't get any Social Security. The bill would have been very devastating for literally tens of thousands of people. And the Supreme Court once again said, look, our Constitution was established for a purpose. It was established to say that we don't want politicians being able to come in and meddle with people's pensions. The temptation is too great to say, hey, let's spend this money for something else. Here,
which is what got us to this point.
Here we've just got this little overtired person. What are they going to be able to do to us when someone more big and powerful wants some of our dollars? Let's give them to them. And the Constitution is very clear, and the Supreme Court reiterated again this week, pension benefits cannot be diminished or impaired. People need those benefits to live in dignity and security in their retirement. And, of course, we're very pleased that the court did affirm that.
They did, it seemed, open the door somewhat to pension changes through a model called consideration or through collective bargaining. So is this something that we know both for the state of Illinois and the city of Chicago? City of Chicago projections are a couple of their pensions for the laborers, municipal workers could be insolvent within a decade, that Illinois is dealing with this more than $100 billion long-term pension debt. Will unions be willing to go in and make changes for the sake of these pension systems, even though kind of that the court has almost said they don't have to?
Well, not only did the court say that unions don't have to, the court pretty much said unions can't for the most part. And I'm going to talk about the one exception there. But the reality is that, yes, there is a large pension debt owed. And why? Because instead of dealing with our state's real fiscal problems, our city's real fiscal problems, the politicians treated workers' pensions as their piggy bank to do with whatever they wanted. And we don't think it's fair to ask retirees, working people, to pay the price for that now. Now, in this case, what the court said about consideration in unions is very important. They gave an example, and it was a very narrow example. What they mean by consideration, they said, yes, you could, for instance, require someone to pay more toward their pension if they were getting an improved benefit when they retire. So just like if someone is paying into anything, if you put in more money, yes, you would expect to have a better return. But the consideration model is based on the idea that you contribute something more and you get something more. And no one has actually proposed that model because that model doesn't really save money. And the reality is that the solution to the pension shortfall is the solution to our, has to be part of an overall financial solution, fiscal solution to our state and our city's revenue problems. And we hear people talk about, well, maybe we have to change the Constitution so we don't protect people's pensions.
You do hear that, yes.
Yes, but why would we do that? Why would we put the retirement security of literally, eventually, millions of people at risk when, if we're going to tamper with our Constitution, in our view, we could readily fix our state's fiscal problems if Illinois, like the great majority of other states, had a tax system based on fair taxation where the wealthy pay a greater share, just like our, under our federal taxes, under tax systems in 35 other states. We have, Illinois has a constitutional prohibition against that kind of fair tax in which the wealthy pay more. If we had that tax system, we would be able to address not only our pension shortfall, but the other revenue problems that plague our state and our city repeatedly.
And I project that we'll be hearing a lot of constitutional amendment talk leading to the November general election that we'll have to get back to in just a moment, though. This is WGN. You can find us at WGNradio.com. And we'll be right back after this break. That's more than just a morning wake-up call. You got a little bit of a Stones concert there from live in Cuba. I am Amanda Vinicky, subbing in for Rick Pearson on the Sunday Spin this happy Easter morning. And I have in studio with me Roberta Lynch. She's director of AFSCME, and we're talking pension cases. So we just had Roberta explain that her belief and what changes could be made to pensions at all for the city of Chicago or the state of Illinois. So I just wanted to touch back and make sure that we're clear. Right now, we have both Governor Bruce Rauner, Senate President John Cullerton saying that they have a plan they believe is constitutional and is backed by the decision that came out on Thursday from the state's high court. Is that not acceptable? Why does that not meet constitutional muster? And it's something that unions had agreed to in principle before.
Without getting into all the legal technicalities.
Yeah, exactly. We want to skip that.
Acceptable.
It's in the morning.
I mean, because basically the way they're discussing it, the example I gave you is exactly the example the court gave in which people contribute more and they have a greater benefit in retirement. The plan that's being bandied about would take something away from people and then to get it back, they would have to pay more toward their pension. We don't think the courts would in any way put a stamp of approval on that kind of idea. That's not fair. You take something away and then you say you have to pay to get it back.
Are there any discussions going on between AFSCME and the legislative leaders at all about any presumed or possible pension changes, anything around consideration or not?
There are no discussions.
Period, really.
No, we've said from the beginning, look, we're prepared to discuss anything that's fair and reasonable. But our fundamental belief is what I said to you earlier. The court, it doesn't have to do with the union, the court is very clear. And in fact, the court specifically said also in this decision, even if the union agreed to something, individuals would still have the right to object and pursue a legal remedy. So I don't think it makes sense to say that why won't the unions compromise and give up people's constitutional rights? It doesn't make any sense to do that. And we don't think it's fair to our members, to working people, teachers, firefighters, police officers, nurses, people who work hard, correctional officers, people who work hard every day. Mm-hmm. We don't think it's fair to say that they should bear the burden of fixing a problem that the politicians created. We've said, let's all work together, and we'll work with anyone of good faith to reform our tax system so that the wealthy pay their fair share and we raise enough revenue to be able to fund our pensions and provide the services that so many citizens depend on. The governor is trying to set it up that to say, well, we need these services, which, by the way, he's cutting off from people right now, but we need these services, so we should take the money from retirees who've worked their whole lives, and now we should try to impoverish them. That doesn't make any sense. Why don't we make the wealthy pay their fair share?
Is there a chance, do you believe, that voters come November will see on the ballot an option to move from a flat tax to some sort of graduated tax system?
I would certainly hope so. I'm not a good political forecaster, I have to say. Certainly that's something that we would like to see. As you know, it's very complicated to get in Illinois. It's very complicated to get a vote like that on the ballot. You need to get a supermajority of legislators just to be allowed to put it on the ballot. So if it were up to me, it would certainly be.
But AFSCME's not pushing
ballot.
That. We're not going to see a big
we're
campaign.
Supporting
You're
that.
Supporting
yes,
the
Yes, we are. But I think it's a high hill to climb when you've got a governor and you've got significant number of legislators who are not in favor of it. It'd be a very high hill to climb. But we're trying. We're trying to climb it. We want to climb it.
So let's talk a bit more about Governor Bruce Rauner. Much of the reason that Illinois is without a budget is because he has a plan that Democrats disdain, as do unions. It really, in many ways, seems to diminish the power of labor in Illinois were he to get his way. And part of that is actually contract negotiations, and those are on hold right now. The governor is seeking an impasse, and a hearing for that before the state labor board will be moving forward. But AFSCME filed its own objection and charge as well as part of this impasse talk. So can you talk about why AFSCME took that action and what you're going to argue at this hearing to try and say, hey, we met for a year trying to get a contract, got nowhere. Why should those talks continue?
I mean, if I can circle around, I'll come back to that question. But you said something at the outset that I wanted to say, because you were talking about why there is this budget standoff. And if you think about it, people all over the state are suffering because we don't have a budget. You know, so many human service groups have had to close the doors. Our state universities are in crisis. College students don't have their MAP grants. And what is it all about? This governor is saying that you said weaken the power of unions, but really what it's about is taking away from working people the ability to have a voice on a job, the ability to affect the conditions of their work. He is saying that in cities and counties all over the state, this is his central demand, teachers, firefighters, police officers, social workers, sanitation workers, librarians should not be allowed to have, under state law, the right to collective bargaining, to be able to have a voice on the job. That's the way that we ensure
safety. He just says he wants
safety.
To change what they can collectively bargain on.
Well, both. In some ways, he said no rights at all. If you look at one of his plans, he has a lot of different positions that he puts out there at different times. But his fundamental plan is to change state law so that you cannot bargain over virtually anything, essentially. And that would mean that it's not just that people don't have the right to bargain over their wages or their health insurance, but also over conditions of work. We bargain over safety conditions. Do we have adequate numbers of staff, both to keep people safe and to provide the services that citizens depend on? So that's a very central and strange situation, if you think about it, that people are suffering all over the state because we don't have a budget. People desperately in need, college students, homeless people, teens needing after-school services. And why are they suffering? Because the governor is demanding that workers should not have a voice on the job. I don't know how, in a state like Illinois, we've come to a situation like that. It's a very dangerous and frightening situation to be in, where one man can put the lives of so many people at risk, both people who depend on the services and funding for those services that the state provides, and working people who depend on having a voice through their union to be able to have safe working conditions, to be able to have a decent standard of living, to be able to have health care benefits and all the things that are so important to all of us.
And the governor would say that it's just gotten – unions have gotten too greedy, that there is an unfair connection between public unions being able to donate to politicians, and through that they've been rewarded with too rich of contracts they can't afford on the state level, and when you go to the municipal level, same thing.
Well, I think if you look at most union contracts, I know many of ours, for instance, recently most of our contracts actually I was just looking recently that the barely keep up with the standard of living, or in some case, or with the wages that if you look at average wage rates around the country and so on, the contracts that people are negotiating are not significantly out of line at all. I mean, the arguments that are being had are not like, oh, you're greedy, you're asking for too much. It's employers coming to the table like the governor and saying, you should be giving back. You should give up wages. You should give back wages. You should cut your pensions. So I really don't see, I mean, for one thing, it's not unions, it's workers. Workers mm-hmm. determine what is being bargained. And I really don't think that most working people that we represent, as I said, correctional officers, yeah. social workers, people in veterans' homes who take care of the aged veterans, people who care for people with mental illness. I think it's really unfair and wrong to say they're greedy. If they're making modest salaries, they're living just a normal life, they're not greedy people. And we certainly, in representing them, are just trying to make sure they have a decent standard of living. And to say for someone who's a billionaire, who spent $27 million of his own money to get himself elected, to call a working person who's making $40,000 a year greedy, I just think that's outrageous. Really, I do.
And Roberto, we've got to get to the news. I want to try and get maybe a quick one-word answer here. As negotiations are at this impasse and we're at that point, could we see AFSCME go on strike? Could it get to that point?
Hope it does not. You know, we represent almost 40,000 state employees. They provide.
Are you making preparations?
They provide so many services that people depend on. I think this governor is trying to force a strike. He said all along he wants a strike. He wants to shut down state government. I think that's irresponsible and wrong, and we want to find a better path.
And with that, we've got to leave it at that. This is the Sunday Spin on Chicago's very own 720 WGN and WGNradio.com.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good morning, Amanda Vinicky here with you this morning in lieu of Rick Pearson as he takes a day off, and we are speaking. One last question, then we'll have to bid adieu to someone who represents many workers, and that is Roberta Lynch. She is director of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, Council 31 here in Illinois. And I'd asked a question earlier, Roberta, about the lack of contract and what is going on in terms of AFSCME getting involved in this impasse situation and what that means.
Well, you know, it was very frustrating, Amanda. We were in bargaining with the Rauner administration almost since they came into office. They came to the bargaining table. You mentioned we were bargaining for a year. That's because they came to the bargaining table with over 200 proposals, in virtually all of which were intended to limit the rights of workers in various ways. So, for instance, the state can, employers in the Department of Corrections, the state can require correctional officers to work overtime, no notice, work double shifts. It's exhausting and it's dangerous for the employees and the whole safety in the correctional system. We had tried to negotiate, and we have over the years, limits on that. You can't be made to work so long. You have to give a notice that you're going to be kept over, et cetera. They came in trying to wipe out those protections. So it took a year, really, to move them off of the really damaging proposals that they had. But we had gotten in to the serious negotiations. They are trying to take away really affordable health care from employees, make it very, very hard for employees to afford their health care. They want to cut wages effectively by raising your health care costs with no pay increase at all. And But all that said, we were at the bargaining table. We were negotiating. We were continuing to negotiate. They just basically said, we're done, and walked away. So you said, why are we at the labor board? We're at the labor board saying, that's a violation of the law. We're in the middle of trying to reach a contract settlement, and they've just walked away from the bargaining table, refused to even talk to us. We had just given them a proposal reducing our previous wage proposal. Instead of coming back and saying, hey, this is a good sign, let's keep talking, they got up, just walked out effectively, and have refused to come back. And we think that's really destructive. That's why we're trying to pass a bill in Springfield now that would actually require the intervention of an independent, non-partial arbitrator to try to resolve these differences, because the governor is unwilling to sit down. He's looking for confrontation. He's trying to force chaos, just like he's forced it by not having a budget. He wants to force chaos and force state workers out on strike. We don't think that's a constructive way to proceed. That's why we're trying to pass a bill that would require arbitration, try to bring the parties together, work out a settlement that's fair to workers and to taxpayers.
And we'll be following that. Thanks so much. That was Director of AFSCME, Roberta Lynch. Somebody who voted for that legislation is Democratic Representative Sarah Feigenholtz. She represents a portion of the city of Chicago and joins me by phone. Thank you so much, Representative.
How are you this morning?
I'm doing great. And I wanted to talk to you. Can you speak as a Democratic legislator in this historic impasse time, how you're talking to constituents and explaining what on earth is going on? Do you see it as Roberta Lynch just described it, as that the governor is trying to force chaos?
You know, I'm hopeful that the governor will continue. I think that the governor realizes that this budget stalemate can't go on forever. It is having such a horrible effect, as Roberta said, on young people who are wanting to plan their summers, plan their college semesters, and move on with their education and careers. I just cannot imagine that this can't just implode. And we have to have a budget. What wouldn't surprise me is if we blend a 16-17 budget together, since it's already so late. But, you know, a few of the things that Ms. Lynch did mention about social services and people losing services is very, very true. We're seeing it in all of our communities across the state of Illinois. And in the context of strategy on the part of the governor trying to make the budget smaller or whatever his goals are, you know, you made a comment that he, you know, or Roberta feels that he's completely anti-union. Of course, that sentiment is, you know, probably interesting but true. He does it in a way that, like, for instance, the 10% of the budget, Amanda, from the social service side that isn't being paid are from non-union providers, mm-hmm. who get paid significantly less to take care of a lot of other people. Also, some of them are. And the more private-looking service providers who are non-unionized have been shut down, too. So to me, that is kind of an interesting and not real strategic strategy. To me, it says, we don't want to take care of these people anymore, whether the workers are union or not, you know? So I'm imploring leaders and people, all of the, you know, myself included. I mean, there are many of us who are working behind the scenes to try and figure out how to break the impasse.
Well, yeah, because that's what people say. What about rank and file legislators? Why do we hear so much talk about the governor and leaders and not the, you know, just a legislator? Can't you do something about it? Aren't there enough of you?
Well, I mean, a lot of us are talking amongst ourselves. I mean, there is a lot of conversation going on, and I think that at the end of the day, you're going to see a compilation of many of those things. And, you know, another thing that the public has to understand, and let's talk a little bit about, you know, non-state government the world that we live in, the restaurants we go to, the hotels we stay at, the people who wake up and go work at McCormick Place or at conferences and conventions around the state. That is fueled by a very strategic, stealth advertising plan. I'm sure you turn your television on and you see a very tranquil lake and says, come to Michigan. You know,
mm-hmm.
Well,
we all know those. They do make me want a vacation.
Yes. Okay. Well, that's the whole point. And Illinois spent our hotels and a lot of our people in the hospitality industry pay into a pot of money. So it's essentially a self tax. They use that money for advertisement. And the impact on our state budget, this was an article written recently in the Chicago Business Magazine, we're losing so much money. We're losing $78 million in revenue simply by this money stuck in the budget. So we're biting our own, you know, it's not good. You know, we're even on the in the business sector, it's been really problematic, and we're bleeding, we're hemorrhaging business, and we're hemorrhaging precious tax dollars from an industry where there is the most job growth in the hospitality industry. So
that is Representative Sarah Feigenholtz. She's a Democrat from Chicago and actually just won an award from the tourism industry, as she notes, struggling. A projection is that a full funding cut, as has been proposed, would mean that Illinois could lose $11 billion of visitor spending over the next 4 years. More on that coming up. Right now, we have a little bit of a break on WGN. This is the Sunday Spin.
Mother, there's too many of you to cry. Brother.
And this is the Sunday Spin. I'm Amanda Vinicky. We have Representative Sarah Feigenholtz on the line, and I've got to let her go quickly. But Representative Feigenholtz, I did want to, while we're on this tourism notion, you were sponsor of a law that did allow for happy hour in the state of Illinois again. Part of why I think you were awarded by the tourism industry. So can I just ask a quick question? Why was that needed, and how's it going?
Well, you know, we had not modernized our hospitality and culinary modernization laws in the state of Illinois and the city of Chicago for a long time. And we needed to revisit it so that it actually reflected the new normal of the food industry. You know, kids grow up now. They're not watching sports as much as they are watching the Food Channel. The back 40 rows of every airplane are loaded with people coming to the city of Chicago who already know what restaurants they're eating at. We are a culinary destination, and we need to make our industry a lot friendlier, and that's what this does. We can now pair beer with food and have fixed-price menus and compete with very, very competitive international destinations like New York, for instance. We also are, for the second year, hosting the James Beard Awards, kind of lured them away from New York. So we have a lot of work to do in this industry, but I will tell you, it is a real revenue source for the state of Illinois, and we need to have a budget in place so that this industry can prop up not only itself, but be part of the solution to the revenue problem. You know, I know that the social service issues are also very important, and the talking about revenue is very important because we do have a very serious revenue problem. And I agree wholeheartedly with many of the things that Roberta Lynch said, but we also have to be wise about this. And it was just an honor to do this law. It was actually, Amanda, all women who wrote the law, the happy hour law. I love to
tell
cheers. That story. And we got it done, and hopefully it's going to make a big difference. I still have a lot of restaurateurs coming up to me and saying, thank you so much. I can be so much more creative with my menus and with my customers. So thanks for mentioning that.
Of course. Well, thank you so much for joining us this morning, Representative Feigenholtz, and everybody maybe think of her the next time you partake in Imbibe in a happy hour. Going to move on now to somebody who I think will have a different take on this budget, and that is some Republican Representative Ron Sandeck from Downers Grove on the line. And Representative Sandeck, a lot of callers saying that they listened or texting in, what have you, heard Roberta Lynch talk of a tax increase and say, hey, union members making too much money. All Democrats want is another tax increase. That's why they believe there is an impasse. Is that what's going on?
Well, it has a lot to do with what's going on, Amanda, as you well know. Look, I listened very closely to Ms. Lynch, and I listened to my friend Representative Feigenholz. And I think there's a little bit of a vacuum in the context, which may explain some of your listeners' angst with what they heard. Look, no one wants to hurt workers. No one wants to hurt any Illinoisans. But the fact is, when you hear Ms. Lynch and frankly, Democrats that have run state government for 12 years talk, it's always taking more from taxpayers. And it's frustrating when we understand the financial difficulties that have one-party rule has brought. Illinois is not it's a high unemployment state. It is a low-growth state. Our economy lags the Midwest, let alone the growth going on throughout the country. And this idea of continuing to do what Democrats have done for 12 years, which is overspend, overpromise, overregulate, and now overtax, and hope that causes growth and opportunity, is just an anathema to most people. So, yes, their perspective is usually very different than what you hear from Ms. Lynch and my Democratic friends on the other side of the aisle.
Given, however, the Supreme Court's decision, you may not like it. A lot of people don't, and they're unhappy and say, hey, let's cut pensions. Given, however, what the Supreme Court has ruled, has it gotten to the point that a revenue increase is necessary, period, just to fund those alone?
Well, there's no question there's a math problem. Of course, there always was a math problem with the pensions. Whether or not you agree with the Supreme Court's ruling, it from a formulaic perspective, it never made sense. Remember, it's a good thing. People are living longer, right? That's a wonderful thing. Modern medicine, good maintenance, exercise, better eating, all great. And that includes Illinois public sector retirees. Good thing. However, these structural retirement plans were never meant to be 30-year or 40-year vehicles. You can't outlive your benefits. This is the same formulaic problem we have, frankly, with Social Security. Of course, the private sector has moved beyond just relying upon someone else to pay or society to pay for all of our collective retirements. So you're right. I do not like the Supreme Court's ruling. I think it's incredibly impractical. However, we're going to have to deal with it, as you mentioned. There's two things we should be doing. One, we should be creating right now a third tranche or a third tier for new employees that start, for instance, January 1st, 2018. Two, yes, we're going to have to figure out how we're going to pay for this continuing pension debacle. I think the governor has indicated he's open to anything and everything, including President Cullerton's ideas. They have been pushed aside, I think, for political purposes. And then three, yes, an Illinois constitutional amendment must occur. You heard Roberta Lynch talk about the need for a minimum wage increase. And you heard her talk about a progressive income tax, which would require a constitutional amendment. What you never hear progressives talk about are term limits, fair maps, and yes, reducing the pension clause, the pension protection clause in our Constitution, which is rather unique. Now, there's a constitutional change I think taxpayers want and desperately need.
And yet there's been no movement in the General Assembly on those term limits or redistricting plans. And Democratic leaders have pretty quickly rebuffed those.
Because it hurts them. Remember, Amanda, you know this. You're a keen observer of the goings-on in Springfield. The folks who control. And when I hear my friend Sarah Feigenholz talk about the budget impasse, I can't disagree with her, except that's the sub-argument or sub-drama or plot going on. The real impasse is over power and control. We have a longtime speaker who's been around for 40-plus years, Speaker of the House for 32 or 35, who runs the General Assembly. This new governor, who is, you know, the executive, the chief executive officer of the state, elected statewide, you know, he runs the day-to-day operations, but he's got no say in what goes on in the House or the Senate. And while term limits and fair maps are overwhelmingly bipartisan, overwhelmingly bipartisan and could help fix the structural deficits our state has. They haven't even seen the light of day to get a vote, and it's really unfortunate and hurtful to the state.
And with that, this is 720 WGN, Chicago's very own. It's 828. And Amanda Vinicky on the Sunday Spin, back again, albeit sadly briefly, with Representative Ron Sandeck. Representative Sandeck, wanted to be sure to say thank you and wish you a happy Easter, and let it be known that while there's plenty to dispute in Illinois state government and a lot still on the table, there is some bipartisanship that occurs. You were a chief co-sponsor of that happy hour bill with Representative Feigenholz, right?
I was, and I enjoyed working with Sarah. I always enjoy those brief, fleeting moments of bipartisanship and look forward to hopefully starting to do so in a real manner on the budget and on governing reforms going forward.
I look forward to speaking with you more about that in the news to come and on Twitter. Ron Sandeck is always available there. Thanks so much.
Now the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Not Rick Pearson this Easter morning. Amanda Vinicky subbing in. This morning has flown. I feel like everybody that has been in the chair here in the Allstate Showcase studio on lovely Michigan Avenue this fine morning, I could have talked to for hours, and a lot of comments coming in from folks as well with opinions on both sides, really all angles of this. Wanted to read aloud one mention that says, when legislators talk about how we can't afford to keep paying pensions for 30 years on workers who've worked to earn that pension, there are issues with legislators who get a governmental pension for a life when they were only elected for a 2-year term and then out of office in cases after just an election or two, and wanting that to be dealt with. So there's a comment from somebody else, but you know, we're going to leave that conversation a bit behind. How can you not talk about the budget? But we will ask about the effect that has had on the Department of Juvenile Justice, because I'm joined now by its director, Candace Jones. And there are some big changes going on with how Illinois deals with youth offenders. First, though, right there, that is a monster task. And we're at a point where state agencies don't have any budgets. You've got a plan for next year. How do you do that 9 months into fiscal year 16? You don't know what you're getting, let alone a new year. What effect has the budget impasse had on your agency?
You hit it on the head. A lot of what it's had, the impact has been on our ability to plan. We are operating right now under a court order. So going into fiscal year 16, because one of the things, and we can talk about this in a second, the agency is under consent decree. So we had to go into the court and get an order to operate. And that really has covered all of our operations, which is important. So we can pay our vendors, we can pay our community providers, but there's no question about it. When I'm projecting out to a new year, or in the instance of reform, trying to innovate above and beyond sort of the bare minimum, it makes it more difficult.
And that is something that really you need to mention anytime you talk about this budget impasse, that Illinois is still spending 90% of what it did last year because there are so many court orders and consent decrees.
Right.
Can you just briefly explain what on earth is a consent decree?
Yeah.
How can it be that without any appropriation, a department is getting funded and there's still money for juvenile justice?
That's a great. So a couple of years ago, 2012, we were sued by the American Civil Liberties Union, and it covered principally three areas, which were the quality of education, the quality of mental health services, and then a bucket that really is safety and security, and that's about everything else. And what that consent decree said was that we were falling behind. A lot of what it talked about were our staffing ratios of youth to staff, the ability to sort of provide the programming we need when we didn't even have the individuals to do it. And so the order really put this pressure on the state to staff up to get these programs in place. So when the budget didn't pass at the end of last year, we had to go back to that same federal judge and sort of say, on the one hand, we're being ordered by the court to comply, but we don't have an appropriated budget. And so the judge, in his authority, said you have to comply. And to do that, you're going to have to at least spend the baseline from the past fiscal year, which was fiscal year 15. And so that's what the order does.
And that's where you have a lot of that going on in government right now. Mm-hmm. And where we hear about Illinois drawing up a deficit, even though there is no budget, is because of those requirements for extra spending. Candace Jones, you mentioned that you're trying to move to reform. What specifically are you looking to change in the Department of Juvenile Justice?
There's a lot that we've been working on. Really, what we're trying to move the state towards, and I say this not to sort of dilute it, but to what works. I think we've talked about it for a long time. At the end of the day, I think what we're all trying to do is achieve public safety. But it forces a conversation about what types of interventions actually get you there, right? And so the way I've talked about our work is really in two big buckets. One is that if what we know from research on public safety and justice-involved youth is that if you have the wrong kids in your prison system, it can increase risk, right? Undercut public
safety. What do you mean wrong kids?
So if you have lower risk kids, mm-hmm. right, lower risk individuals come into the system and then you surround them with higher or moderate risk kids, you actually drive up their risk level.
They're going to
you increase
make
the likely-
friendships that are not healthy. They're going to get more into trouble.
You do two things. You drive up their risk by surrounding them, which is one of the biggest risk indicators, which is antisocial peers. What you're saying exactly. And then you also erode protective factors, which is their connection to school, pro-social activities, family, right?
So you take them out of school. You take them away from their home base and move them into a prison sort of structure.
Right. So you can be in some ways undercutting what you're ultimately trying to do, which is protect public safety. At the same time, for those moderate to high-risk kids who do end up in the system and who need to be separated from society, if you're not doing anything with them in the time that they're in your custody, you also aren't ultimately serving public safety because you're not getting them any of the protective factors they'll need to succeed when they go home. They're not getting the educational interventions. They're not being stabilized on their medication. They're not getting the mental health support that you know is going to help the transition home and keep them out. So a lot of what we've been working on, as broad as it seems, is both of those. Having this conversation in the state about who should be served by the deep end system and then really what we do for those that come to us.
And what do you do in determining who, as you said, goes into the deep end system? I mean, that is, we have laws. If you commit a crime, something has to be done about it. You can't just hang out at home and get a slap on the wrist.
Right. A lot of what we've done in the last year is talk about that, though. One thing that Illinois was doing up until January of 2016 was we still have misdemeanors in our system. So in Illinois, like you say, we have laws. If you're an adult and you commit a misdemeanor, you couldn't go to the Department of Corrections, right? We say, too low level, we're not going to send you to prison for that. If you were a youth, you could come to the Department of Juvenile Justice. And so last spring, we actually changed that to say, you know, counties can do redeploy, they can do probation, they can do intensive probation, they can work with a community provider to do a cognitive behavioral therapy. But if ultimately what you've committed is a misdemeanor, do we want the response to be prison?
So are there fewer juveniles in the system right now because of that?
Yeah, there are.
And with that, I think we need to take a break. This is WGN 720, and this is the Sunday Spin. Good Easter morning, Amanda Vinicky, your host for One Day and One Day Only, although hopefully I'll be back at some point, for Rick Pearson, taking, as I put it, really a well-deserved day off. So be thinking of him while you're sipping your coffee and flipping through your Sunday Tribune. We're going to round out the show, continuing to speak with the Department of Juvenile Justice Director Candace Jones, appointed to that position by Governor Bruce Rauner. And Director Jones, we have a hearing coming up, actually, in coming days, to deal with something that you usually is a facility closure. Mm-hmm. And I've covered a lot of those in my job as a State House Bureau Chief for Public Radio. And oftentimes there's a lot of pushback.
Yeah.
Legislators don't like it when a facility closes. That means a loss of jobs. But in this point in time, you are getting support from a lot of legislators and actually advocates of juvenile justice for closing the Kewaunee facility.
Yeah.
Why are you making that move?
We're making the
move. We're trying to, I guess.
Yeah, we're trying to make... I've proposed that closure with the administration proposing that closure really because two reasons. Programmatically, it makes sense. We've struggled there. If you look at some of our consent decree findings, when we came under consent decree, we got some national appointed experts to take a look. And one of the places programmatically we've struggled the most is in Kewaunee. We've had a hard time hiring the staff that we need to be able to run that sort of programming that we talked a little bit about earlier. And if we're moving to a system that will get us to the end that we want, better programs, better public safety, we'll struggle the most there. And that combined with our capacity, which has also declined, makes the case for closure make sense.
You know, is there any situation, however, where you want to get kids into these facilities? You know, you talked about the trouble with that, but at the same time, troubled youth who has the option of going somewhere where they're supposed to be care that is not just punishment, but it's also rehabilitative,
right,
versus staying out on, you know, the metaphorical streets.
Yep. We absolutely want to be able to do that. And I mean, in as much as we've sort of in the state said you can't bring misdemeanors to the juvenile justice system, at the same time last year we said more serious young offenders who otherwise were ending up in the adult system need to come back to the juvenile system so they can get those interventions too. So we're making trade-offs about how that system is serving higher risk youth. And right now I have about 1,000, just under 1,000 bed capacity and 420 youth. So even once we remove Kewaunee, 354 beds, we'll still have enough beds in the system to have some play when we have seasonal fluctuations of the number of youth, or if we make some policy changes and determine another set of youth are appropriate for the system.
Let's talk briefly about what happens when you have youth offenders that are brought in and then it's time for there to be released. Northwestern recently came out with a report on the rehabilitative release of youth, and it says, quote, Illinois is the only state in the country that gives an adult-focused parole board, that being the Illinois Prisoner Review Board, the power to release youth. And instead, this report says that it should be empower you and the Department of Juvenile Justice should be empowered to make those decisions. Is that something that you want, or what is wrong with putting that in the hands of a prisoner review board, experts to determine when these offenders should be released?
So much of what we've done with the Department of Juvenile Justice in the last decade, so I know you know, the department actually is in its infancy as an agency. It was created, you know, it was a carve out of the Department of Corrections in 2006. Not until 2011 as a pilot and then 2014 as a full statewide rollout did we have post-release supervision or aftercare. So before, the Department of Corrections staff were still supervising youth and community, and we just changed that. And really the last vestiges of an adultified model is having this parole board that makes decisions about youth and adults focused on our youth, because in the last year we've rolled out a risk assessment instrument that's consistent with what's being used by probation departments all over the state of Illinois to use an objective tool to make decisions about risk and how you should be supervised. And the youth are in our custody, which is one of the reasons why in most states the department makes that decision, because they actually know the individual that they're making the decision about. I do believe it's more appropriate to move us in line with the rest of the nation.
Not to go all over the place here, but I did want to make sure that we got in a question that a caller texted in, I believe, and they are curious, why close Kewaunee and not the Para Marquette facility, particularly once you compare the worth of those properties once they're closed, the population and the staff?
Yeah. The reason to close Kewaunee, Para Marquette is a 40-bed facility down by St. Clair. When you look at some of our data outcomes and our performance-based standards, which is a set of standards where all juvenile correctional facilities in the country are compared to one another, right? So it's not just Illinois. It's stacking us up against the nation. One of our best performers consistently is Para Marquette. It's a small therapeutic setting consistent with a national best practice model of small regional. And this idea that when you serve some of the state's highest risk youth in smaller settings with good staff to youth ratio, you'll yield the best outcomes. It really is sort of leading our pack in programmatic outcomes. And that's why what you're paying for there is that outcome. And it makes sense, definitely, not just to hang on to a facility like that, but to fight for it.
Now, I know that we began our conversation speaking about the budget impasse and its direct impact on your department. You've got this consent decree. But what about the indirect offsets of that? Have you noticed any sort of troubling trends with an increase in offenders? I know, for example, just this week, there was a program, the Youth Services Network in Rockford, that has already dropped its Redeploy Illinois program. It has scaled back shelter services for youth, and now a 24-hour crisis line is gone. And all of these things are meant to help kids in trouble and prevent them from going into the prison system.
Yeah. A healthy continuum helps, right? Like, you're spot on. While we are not yet seeing, and some of it is related, so if a program has just recently or in the last month closed, it'll take some time before that impact is felt in my system, but there's no question about it. I have and will continue to advocate for a healthy continuum. We are as good as we actually have services in the community for court officials, local officials to say, okay, I don't want to commit this youth, but what else can I do? It has an impact. And operationally on us, I mean, we are spending more time being in constant contact with vendors and contractors, just making sure, even though we're paying them, that they're still going to deliver and give us all the services we need so that we can continue to operate.
And finally, let's touch on a decision by actually the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yeah.
And they had said that no more mandatory life terms without parole for juvenile offenders. And that has been said it can be applied retroactively as well for youth in the system. Where is that at in Illinois and for teens that are serving those sort of sentences? Where are we at in any insight?
Yeah, there were a couple of decisions. The first, a few years ago, basically said that they were banning walking away from life without parole. And I think there was some disagreement amongst the states about whether or not that would have retroactive application. They clarified that, as they are known to do in this recent decision in Montgomery. Now, what had happened in Illinois was Leader Curry and I believe the co-sponsor had been Senator Harmon had run a bill about juvenile life without parole in the state to sort of settle the ground here. But even with this new precedent, I think it'll have a broader sweeping scope on the decision and the legislation we've run. So we'll have to look to our legislature about whether or not they're just going to accept the finding or whether or not they'll go and expand the legislation that was previously run. But I think we're moving in the right direction, which is this acknowledgement that they're developmentally different, and so the system's response has to be consistent with that.
So much to follow in Springfield as the legislative session continues, or actually resumes in April. I'm Amanda Vinicky. This is WGN and the Sunday Spin. This is Amanda Vinicky with the Sunday Spin. I'm about to leave you now, but wanted to make sure and say thank you to Department of Juvenile Justice Director Candace Jones for joining me this Easter morning and wishing all of you a very happy chocolate-eating sunshiny day. So thank you very much. I appreciated the opportunity to be here. And Rick Pearson, the grand, the wonderful, the insightful, will be back next week. With that, good morning. There.
I was hoping you'd be back next week.
I can come and hang out. I like it here.
We like it when you're here.
Thank you.
I'm not slamming Rick at all. I'm just saying, somebody tell me, not much more pleasant to see this coming into the studio than cranky old Rick every yelling at politicians every Sunday morning. Great show.
Thanks.
Really, really interesting. Nice to have you here with us.